Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today on Studio Tulsa, we learn about the nonpartisan community organizing group Action Tulsa. Throughout the midterm election cycle, they've been conducting something called accountability sessions with political candidates for district attorney, congressional district 1, and state house districts in the Tulsa area. Action Tulsa leaders say accountability sessions are very different than your traditional candidate forums or debates, in that the candidates spend time first listening to personal stories of their constituents on a given issue before being asked about their position and whether they'd work for an outcome the organizing group wants, a position that's been hammered out through consensus within the group. The next accountability session takes place Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at St. Matthew's Methodist Church in East Tulsa with the candidates for State House Districts 75 and 76. I'm joined by the president of the board of Action Tulsa, Deanna Tyrrell, and Emma Fadani, the chair of the immigration team of Action Tulsa. Deanna and Emma, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Tell us a little bit about Action. Action's been around for a couple of years, and I know this organizing group has come out of the grassroots and involves a lot of different organizations, a lot of churches in the area. Tell us a little bit about how this came together.
Well, Action actually started about 4 years ago when a group of pastors in Tulsa began to be concerned because they saw that there was a breakdown in our democratic system, in the way politics was not working very well for ordinary people. Several of these pastors had worked with a community organizing network called the Industrial Areas Foundation, and they wanted to bring that kind of organizing to Tulsa. So they began working with the network and pulled together institutions, churches, and nonprofits to start thinking about what are the values we have in common, even if we are different religions or we are secular. What are the what's the common good, and how can we bring people together to work for that?
Now, Deanna mentioned a few pastors came together, but this is not a religious organization.
Right.
It's more about community issues?
Mm-hmm. And so we're actually, right now, we've developed into a coalition of 20 institutions that can be either nonprofits or faith-based organizations. So, for example, I am a member of a nonprofit organization, whereas Deanna comes through a church. And so I think that's a really exciting part about Action, because oftentimes there is not that overlap and that opportunity to collaborate.
And so Action looks at a variety of community issues and comes up with positions and works towards making them so?
In a way. Now, all of our issues, it's not the group of leaders that come together and decide what issues we're going to address. We always begin our work with conversations, with building relationships. So it might be a one-on-one conversation with people in the community or people in our own institutions. We bring together small groups. And one question we always ask, what is the greatest challenge facing you and your family right now? And from those stories, we develop the agenda of issues. We've spent 2 years working on one that we've used for this election cycle. Some of those issues include public education funding and how the lack of that is harming our families, concerning our parents. Another issue that came up was on criminal justice issues, families that have been impacted by the increased incarceration, by the harsh sentencing laws. And so hearing those stories grounds our work in the experiences of real people.
So how do you try to address that?
Right. So with that, once we've identified some of those issues, we then decided to form some teams, some action teams to work on those. So for example, Deanna mentioned criminal justice. So we do have a criminal justice team who helped put together an accountability session with the district attorney's candidates. And so that was really powerful, a really great opportunity to see how we can really address that issue. We also have a student loan debt team. So that's something that has come up at a lot of different institutions as a huge need. And that team is working on how can we make a difference and how can we educate people about what's happening with student loan debt.
Now, you chair the immigration team. What are some of the work your team is doing?
Yeah. So with the immigration team, that really came out of what was happening about a year ago and a lot of people just really concerned. And then we have several institutions that have a large number of immigrants who are part of their congregation. So we wanted to make sure we could address it. We have done a very large event last year that was about DACA. We had about 300 people attend and went through all of the different bills that were being considered at the time. And then since then, we've really focused on these house meetings that Deanna mentioned, really bringing together immigrants and trying to figure out what is the biggest challenge that is affecting your family, and then what can we then do to address that? So it's an ongoing process.
Well, and that shows you the frustration sometimes of community organizing. You had mentioned all these bills that are out there. None of them got through, not even through one House of Congress.
Right.
So how do you regroup and continue to focus that issue for people who are now running for election?
Right. That's a really, really good question. I think with immigration, it has been more challenging because it's such a federal issue. But something that we have been asking our legislative officials, the people running for the state offices, is will you ensure that we are not doing anything to harm the immigrant community? Because that's something that we can push for here locally. And then we're also, again, just doing some research and figuring out what are some local issues that we can focus on when we know that a lot of this is out of our control.
So another big part of our work is building relationships. Mm-hmm. So when we bring candidates together, we have met with them ahead of time just to have those conversations about here's the stories we've heard that have led to the questions we're going to be asking you. And one of our big asks of any candidate, any elected official, is will you continue to be in conversation with us? And that right there is the very basis of what we do, having relationships and ongoing conversations, not to solve everything overnight, but to continue to look at what might be possible.
I'll add one more thing. Something else when we do these small group meetings is identifying future leaders. And so particularly, again, with the immigration team, I'm on the lookout when we're having these meetings for people who might be able to take on some of those projects and lead them and be our speakers and share stories. And I think that's another way that we can keep this going, even when there's a lot of frustrations.
Now, Action Tulsa is sponsoring a number of accountability sessions during this election cycle. You had the three during the primary season for several House districts in the Tulsa area. And your next accountability session is, again, two more House districts in Southeast Tulsa and Western Broken Arrow and mm-hmm. House District 75 and 76. You've had two others already this year. So what are accountability sessions? What do you mean by that term as opposed to a candidate forum or debate or the usual terms we use when you get two candidates together and you want to hear what their views are?
So our structure is very different, and we call it an accountability session for a reason, because our goal really is to present actions, issues, what is our agenda that we've developed, what are we working on, and then asking these candidates, can we hold you accountable to working with us and to committing to work with us on these issues? Because we do believe we are electing these officials and we want to work with them. They represent us and we need to have that relationship. So with that, the structure is very different. We have individuals come and share their stories about the issues that we have been working on. We have then a chance for the candidates to answer questions that are very targeted to those issues. And we do ask for a yes or no response from the candidates and then note those down so we can then follow up with them.
That's a very pointed session. And, you know, candidates, you know, I always like to say they promise everything, you know, they'll promise you anything when they're running for office and promise you nothing once they're elected. But that's really a very pointed session towards getting a direct answer.
It is. And I think, as Emma mentioned, that we always ground our issues in the stories we've mm-hmm. heard, stories from real people that are experiencing the effects of whatever policy or law that we are asking to have changed. And many times, even the candidates will tell us afterwards, I really didn't understand how that impacted this person sitting right beside me. And that creates that empathy and that compassion, that understanding of the common good. It's not something to always be viewed through a partisan lens. We're a nonpartisan organization. We're very focused just on the issues. We will work and ask to work with all the candidates, all the elected mm-hmm. officials. I think one other aspect of our questions is they are long because they always start out with a little bit of education. Here's what's been happening. Here's some numbers and facts. And so now we ask you how you will address this. So when you come to an accountability session, you have both your head and your heart engaged.
Mm-hmm. Now, an old campaign tactic for many, many years has been when a candidate gets a question he doesn't want to, or he or she doesn't want to answer, it's immediately to flip the question to something they can answer. How do you hold them accountable for that? I assume that's something you run into.
Yeah.
Yes. In fact, in one of the House, accountability sessions we had, I chaired the District 69 one, and the skills that we have learned, the training that we've had with our professional organizer addresses that. We rehearse before our accountability session so that we are comfortable that when a candidate strays from the script or begins to do something else, like attack an opponent that we have told them we will not allow, I say, Mr. So-and-so, that is not answering the question. Will you please answer the question? Yeah. And so this is part of the leadership skills, the growth that we offer to the people that work with us, and having that confidence in knowing that all the leaders are there with you and support you in that, and we recognize that importance.
And we also, I think a really important component is that we meet ahead of time with all the candidates and have a conversation. So we have a sense of where they may stand, and we've talked about it. So the goal is never to blindside anybody. We really had a conversation about it, and they know what we're working on and what to expect.
So when you do have an accountability session, do each of the teams contribute questions? Or so it's a number of questions, or is it, say, when you met with the DAs, was it mainly the criminal justice team?
It was primarily. It depends on what the race is about. So the criminal justice team did primarily contribute to that. But again, immigration, mental health, student loan debt, education, all of those are, all those teams have done research, heard the stories, and they suggest to the planning team, you might want to ask them this. We think this should be addressed. So it's very much consensus leadership. Mm-hmm. I think Emma talked about that earlier. And the idea that it's not one or two people at the top. We believe in distributed leadership. We want to invest in the people in Tulsa to grow their own leadership, to solve their own problems.
Right. Now, you've come up with consensus positions that you want accountability on. I assume the process to getting to consensus is a long, laborious one.
Yeah, and a continuous one, for sure. I mean, we mentioned with the House meetings, it is an ongoing process, and it's something that could change. So we could certainly shift, our issues could adjust a little bit. I have a feeling some of them will continue because we have not yet solved them. But again, education funding was something that kept coming up over and over again, and so that is something that we'll work on. But if another issue is mentioned that maybe only a handful of people are interested in, then that's not going to be something that we focus on. And as action, we do have a strategy team meeting where all of the institutions have a representative present, and it has to be something that everyone is okay to move on with. So yes, it's a process.
And there may be some issues that we don't reach consensus on, but if there's something that we decide not to address, there's no shortage of things we do agree on that need to be improved.
My guests today are Deanna Tyrrell, the president of the board for Action Tulsa, and Emma Thadani, the chair of the immigration team. Action Tulsa's next accountability session will take place Sunday afternoon at 3:00 at St. Matthew's Methodist Church with the candidates for State House District 75 and 76. And of course, this will be the last accountability session, right, for this election cycle.
It will. And so our work will shift. We've been operating on a 3-prong approach of educate, elect, and engage. So after the election, we will begin to focus on engaging our elected officials to continue this conversation. We'll continue with House meetings and small group meetings in our institutions to continue to find out what is challenging people in our city and how can we address that.
So let me ask you a question. You've had 5 sessions already, House District 71, 79, and 69 during the primaries, and you've done one of the DA candidates and one of the first district candidates, which we'll talk about that in a moment. What have you learned from these accountability sessions with these various candidates?
I'm always reminded of just how valuable it is to have this different format. I think there are a lot of opportunities to see candidates in a debate setting. And like you mentioned, sometimes they will make a point that is not what we're trying to get to. So I think it's really valuable to ask those targeted questions. I also am always reminded of the power of individual stories. And we've heard so many from a wide variety of different leaders, some of whom have never spoken in public before and are brave enough to stand up there and share really personal, hard stories. And I love watching when candidates connect to that. And I think that happens very frequently, like Deanna mentioned, or maybe something they hadn't realized. So it really is so powerful to connect everything back to those stories.
But do you think just hearing a personal story can actually make a change in a candidate?
I do. They may connect it to something in their own experience, their own family. We had a candidate last Sunday who very clearly said, I can relate to that because I've had similar issues. And that was really powerful for the crowd. And I think too often, laws or bills that are put forth are just words and numbers on a page. I mean, there's no way any elected official can have all personal experiences. And so by bringing forth the stories around our specific issues, they are face-to-face, again, sitting next to someone on the stage who they now have a connection with, and they have to recognize that maybe not that I need to do exactly this thing that they want, but just the idea that I need to keep this person in mind when I am addressing that issue.
Even if the story they're relating and the solution or this accountability that you want is contrary to their ideology?
Perhaps, yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Like I said, we may not get the exact solution, the exact change in the law that we want, but I do believe that empathy and compassion lies in each of us, and those candidates have an opportunity then to experience that in a way that may help them continue to grow in that issue.
Yeah. And I think from meeting with several candidates, I think they're very receptive to that because a lot of their role when campaigning is going out and hearing stories from their constituents. And so this is a variation of that. It's happening on a stage, but very similar to if they're going out and knocking on doors and hearing stories, a lot of them are going to be the same issues.
Yeah.
And for those candidates who perhaps are less interested in connecting with their potential constituents that way, it says something about who they are as a candidate.
Now, you've had two this fall for the Republican and Democratic nominations for district attorney. What did you learn in that session?
I think people were a little bit surprised, two ways. First, some very major ways they differed in how they would approach. I guess one example was making State Question 780 retroactive. They had very different approaches in that, and both had, you know, arguments and understandings about here's why I feel that way.
And 780 is the bill that made several drug crimes mm-hmm. that used to be felonies now misdemeanors, and
yes,
people are
right.
imprisoned.
Yes, thousands
under a felony conviction,
right.
And now what they were convicted of is now a misdemeanor.
Right. So we are keeping those people from coming back to being a productive part of our society. But I think some of the other things we found is that on the idea of some rehabilitative or alternative ways, especially for low-level and first-time offenders, mm-hmm. the candidates both agreed that that was important. And so that's one of the things that we need to know is where they stand. But also both of them offered to continue to meet with us and work mm-hmm. with us. And that's the primary goal of an accountability session.
One striking takeaway from the DA session in particular was the lack of funding provided to the DA's office, and both candidates brought that up and addressed it really well in a way that would be a way to solve it in the future. But basically, they're relying on fines and fees in order to continue their work and actually have a functioning DA office. And so that's something that we are then taking into account when we organize our future accountability sessions. That's a state-level issue, so can we try to work on that at the state level so that that will help at the local level?
And, of course, the courthouses often are funded through fees
right.
and penalties, yeah,
right,
like
right.
that. Well, the next one was with the first district, and this is a question I wanted to ask, is what do you do when one candidate decides not to be a part of an accountability session, which is what happened in the first district?
You are persistent, and I think that the folks who were organizing it was mainly the social work, the National Association of Social Workers took this one on in particular, as well as the immigration team, and they were very persistent. They made phone calls, they visited the office in person, actually sent a certified letter to the candidate, so we really did try as much as we could. But once the session was over, we said, okay, what can we continue to do? And so we are still calling still sending emails and wanting to find answers to those questions, because it is really important to know how this candidate would respond.
And do you learn much from this session just with one candidate?
I think we did. I think people gained an understanding. Again, this was one of our first sessions with federal level candidates. And the candidate that was there provided a really strong connection for our issues with what we see happening federally. I mean, we'd done the research to answer the questions, and he confirmed that a lot of what we were asking, and that, yes, it's something that can be addressed at that level. And the empty chair just says volumes.
It does.
So this weekend, this Sunday, you'll be having accountability sessions with the candidates for State House District 75 and 76. This is districts in East Tulsa, Southeast Tulsa, and Western Broken Arrow. What are some of the things you want to hear from these candidates?
Right. So we, since this is a state race, a lot of these are applicable to other state races that are happening. We're not really focusing in on that specific region, but we like that area because it does overlap with Broken Arrow Public Schools, Union, as well as Tulsa Public. So it's really interesting area.
Well, from your point of view, yeah, the immigration team, this is a heavy, East Tulsa,
absolutely,
especially, is,
yes,
is one of our most yeah, diverse parts of the city.
Exactly. And so we're hoping to get a lot of those folks to turn up and also to participate in this, to show our candidates that, yes, this is the community that you're representing. But we will focus, again, mainly on those issues, particularly education funding, criminal justice, again, student loan debt, and then immigration, what can be done at the state level.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a really interesting session. I imagine you learn a lot, through the primary process, you learned a lot about the candidates then. I assume you'll learn a lot this weekend, right?
We have. And not only about the candidates, but again, one of our primary purposes as ACTION is to provide education and training to grow leaders. Mm-hmm. So at each of these accountability sessions, we may have 10 volunteers up at the front, different people at each one, who are practicing what they've learned to be leaders, and then they can take that back to their own institution. They can take that into the community, and just building that power together, that understanding that we as constituents have a right to be at the table, a right to have our issues heard. By working together, we can make ourselves heard better.
So this takes place Sunday afternoon at 3:00 at St. Matthew's Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. Anybody's invited, right?
Yes. So one interesting thing is that each institution will commit to bringing a certain number of people. So we generally have a pretty good sense of how many people will be there. But this is a public ACTION, so it's open to the public. In the primaries, we averaged about 100 people. We've been averaging 150 to 200 at the last ones. In fact, several candidates have said, I've never been to an event with this many people. But that's the power of organizing with institutions. But yes, everyone is welcome.
All right. And if people want more information on ACTION, how do they find it?
We have a website. They can search or go to actiontulsa.org. We also have a Facebook page. You can search ACTION Tulsa. On the website there, you can register to sign up and get more information.
All right. Well, Emma and Deanna, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Deanna Tyrrell is the president of the board for ACTION Tulsa. Emma Thadani is the chair of the immigration team. ACTION Tulsa's next accountability session takes place this Sunday afternoon at 3:00 at St. Matthew's Methodist Church with the candidates for State House District 75 and 76. By the way, there'll be real-time translation into Spanish available for the event. Information on the organization at actiontulsa.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Mark Dara.
If you drive west from Tulsa on U.S. Highway 412, you will reach a junction. If you go left, the road takes you into some of Oklahoma's richest farmland in the town of Fairview. If you go right, you pass through the Glass Mountains and on to Woodward. A sign at this junction reads, Orienta. Not much remains of this community. At one time, it was a station on the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Railroad, thus the community's name, Orienta, the rail line's nickname. In the very early 1900s, Arthur Edward Stillwell dreamed of making Kansas City a gateway to the Far East. He planned a 1,600-mile railroad that would run between a seaport on the Gulf of California and Kansas City. Stillwell gathered investors, raised money, bought rights of way, and began construction of the rail lines through Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, while at the same time, work began south of the Rio Grande, through the desert of Chihuahua, and on to the rugged Sierra Madre. It was an audacious dream. Stillwell ran out of money when the tracks reached Alpine, Texas. In the meantime, revolution rocked Mexico, and one of Stillwell's former contractors, Pancho Villa, began blowing up sections of the Orienta that had been completed. The Kansas City-Mexico and Orient Railroad never crossed the border between the United States and Mexico. If you drive on about 2 hours south and west of Orienta, you will eventually arrive at the Oklahoma Air and Spaceport in Burns Flat. It is one of only 10 spaceports in the United States, and the only one not in restricted airspace or in areas of military operations. The Oklahoma Spaceport has a runway almost 3 miles long, and it's as wide as a football field is long. It may be the most ideal location for spacecraft arrivals and departures in the country. In recent years, Oklahoma Spaceport has been used for flight training, testing of outer space prototypes, and trying out new systems on airplanes still in development. To date, though, no spaceships have taken off or landed at the Burns Flat Spaceport. But a band of ardent supporters still work and hope for that day. They believe in the infinite potential of audacious dreams. I want to be in Burns Flat when that first spaceship takes off, just as I would have loved to have been in Orienta the day the first Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient train passed through. Grand acts of the imagination inspire. Timid increments don't. In the meantime, the citizens of Burns Flat, Oklahoma, wait. Some, I'm sure, have wondered whether having such a perfect landing strip for planes from outer space might attract others exploring the universe. And if so, maybe some of the locals speculate how many hundreds of thousands of dollars the National Enquirer might pay them for their stories of being the first human beings to interact with extraterrestrials. Audacious dreams.
Mark Dara is an attorney and writer and the author of an essay collection titled A Catalog of Common People. He's a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.